And now for something completely different.
Forget everything you've been told by others before. Get ready for the real deal. The full story. The whole enchilada. It's the Lance Roberts Show. Presented by Clarity Financial. It's life, money, and sweat equity. Now, welcome in to the Lance Roberts Show.
And welcome to the Lance Roberts Show today. It is 3 o'clock here as we wrap up the market day. Well, it's 3 o'clock Central Time, 4 o'clock Eastern Time. And, of course, right now the markets are closing up for the day. And, again, the disappointing side of today is just like yesterday. We started out yesterday rocketing out of the gate on trade news and trade issues that may be improving. Markets were up 30, 35, 40 points yesterday morning. Sold off actually went negative before recovering up about 10 or 15 points yesterday. Exact same story today. Markets rocketed out of the gate this morning on the back of, well, progress with trade. China saying they're going to buy 500,000 tons of soybeans. And of course, it's got the markets really rolling this morning. But later today, smart money coming in, pension funds, et cetera, hedge funds selling off today. We're finishing up the day up about 13 points. A very disappointing showing for the markets yesterday. And again, this follows on the back of this from yesterday, is that we can simply not hold a rally at this point. We did add a small trading position going into the holiday trading season. Again, that begins, and we talked about this yesterday with Michael Leibowitz, is that the best opportunity for a bounce in the market over the next few days is going to be the rest of this week and into next week, heading into Jerome Powell's speech on the 18th and 19th about Fed policy. But at this point, we have been unable to hang on to any gains here. So again, be very cautious with your trading. We're still holding a lot of cash. About 20% of our portfolio still remains in cash, not to mention our fixed income positions. But again, this inability for markets to hold on to gains here certainly weighs on the market's outlook over the course of the next few days and as we go into next week. Stops are still holding at these recent lows at 26.33. That is your critical stop level. Pay attention to that. Breaks below that, we're going to retest the lows back from February. Below that, things get ugly pretty quick. So, and particularly as we wrap up this year and get ready to head into next year, that's a side that we don't want to be on. Global economic growth is weakening. Interest rates are still rising. But most importantly, the Federal Reserve continuing to reduce their balance sheet. We're going to take a quick break. We're going to come back, pick up with Peter Atwater, behavioral scientist, talking about the markets, your money, and what it means going forward in the next couple of years, really, and what the market outlook is going to look like. Peter Atwater coming up next from Financial Insights. Don't go away.
Catch the Lance Roberts Show anytime, day or night, online at LanceRobertsShow.com. Lance Roberts returns.
If your choice is death or listen to Lance Roberts, I'm sure I might win at least 20% of those.
So Feel Better has a value.
I need Aggie math.
Starting Monday, January 7th at 6 a.m. on AM 700, the voice of Texas.
Welcome to the Lance Roberts Show podcast today here at realinvestmentadvice.com. Our special guest today, Peter Atwater. He's the president of Financial Insights, the why of what we do. Financial-insights.com. That's financial-insights, and that's spelled INSYGHTS.com. I think Peter must be British. Research of confidence-driven decision-making, adjunct professor, College of William & Mary, University of Delaware. Peter, of course, writes and speaks extensively about changes in confidence that affect our preferences, decisions, and actions. In his recent book, Moods and Markets, Financial Times Press 2012, details how investors can improve returns using non-market indicators of confidence. And we're going to talk about confidence today, Peter, because right now, at least, it seems the market doesn't have a whole lot of it. What's your takeaway here? You know, we've had this, very strong advance over the last decade and lots of record confidence levels late last year and even really early this year. And really, over the course of the last several months, a lot of that confidence seems to have come off the bloom off the rose, so they say. What are you making of all this?
So I think that the end of last year, the beginning of this year, was the peak in confidence for this cycle. So for the post-banking crisis recovery, that was the top. And I offer that because extreme confidence is reflected in extreme behaviors. And to me, the greatest example of that was the cryptocurrency bubble. And you had very similar behavior to what we saw at the peak of the dot-com bubble, where people were embracing this very innovative, very speculative technology. And that is very typical of what you see at extremes in confidence. And I always laugh because coincidental with this peak in cryptocurrencies, you also saw the Tide pod eating craze. And so you had people doing really bizarre extreme behaviors, and that is typically what we see at peaks in confidence.
Well, it's also interesting to me, Peter, because when you take a look at confidence levels and whether, and actually you kind of look at it across a broad measure of things, right? So peak ISM manufacturing, peak ISM services indexes, peak confidence levels, peak investor confidence levels. And it's interesting to me, I wrote some articles on this, talking about peaks are always what you see at the ends of the cycle, not the beginning. But yet when you listen to the mainstream media, like, oh, this economy is going to go on for another decade. Why? Because we have peak confidence levels in the markets. And that's not ever been the case historically. Why do people misinterpret peak confidence with what the outcomes have actually been?
Because they extrapolate. And those extrapolations, as a behavioral scientist, are critical to me, because what I'm looking for are people looking at the future in ways that are even brighter than today. And to give you a great example of that, you saw that at the beginning of October with oil prices, where mm-hmm. people were expecting $100 oil prices. You saw the same thing with interest rates, where everyone was expecting rates to continue higher.
Right.
So it's that sentiment of ongoing excess from here that is what defines the top.
Well, and it's interesting you bring up interest rates, because I've been writing since the beginning of this year that rates couldn't go up, you know, substantially more, because we have so much of our consumer confidence tied to debt. And ultimately, those rising interest rates were going to cause a problem for households when they couldn't afford the payment. And yet, you know, we're now seeing that start to creep through here in, you know, housing sales, auto sales, et cetera. And, you know, from a behavioral standpoint, you know, I think this is the one thing that the markets tend to overlook, is how people respond to changes in their environment. Do you see the same thing?
Yeah, particularly right now in the rate area, because you would expect, you know, what we were hearing coming into October was that higher rates were going to be suffocating to the housing market.
Right.
So now we have lower rates. And what are we seeing? Lower mortgage applications. So I think that what people mistake is this causal relationship. And it's really significant to me that falling interest rates are not bringing more demand into housing. They're not bringing renewed interest in credit products. In fact, it's just the opposite.
Well, you know, it's interesting that you say that, Peter, because, you know, it's one of those things where when rates go up, this is a good example. I think houses are always a great example, because for me, when I look at how even I've bought houses in the past, people don't buy houses, they buy payments, right? So if they're going to buy a $500,000 house or a $300,000 house or whatever it is, they don't ask, well, you know, how much is the house? They say, well, how much is that going to cost me every month? And so they factor in this payment structure. So when rates move up, they go, one of two things is going to happen. Either A, rates move up and they say, well, I can't afford the payment. Or B, when rates go up, they go, well, you know what? Rates tend to come back down. I'll wait until the rates come back down again. And then to your point, when rates do come down, then they say, well, I'm going to wait longer to see if rates go lower and I get a better price. And that is the very essence of deflation, which is where people began to wait for lower prices.
Yeah, and I think we're seeing a lot of that it reflected this Christmas season, where 10% discounts in clothing have become 20%, 40%, and now 60%. So consumers are learning that it does pay to wait.
Well, and again, Peter, I'm sure you've already done all of your Christmas shopping at this point, right?
I'm actually taking some stuff back today because the discounts got too ridiculous to not.
See? Smart shopping. This is what I like. So let's talk about something else. I want to change gears here just a bit because we're going to come back to confidence here in just a moment. Because look, this whole environment that we've been in over the last decade in particular is a function of confidence, whether it was misplaced or not, because of the actions, in my opinion, of the Federal Reserve. Over the last decade, we've had repeated interventions by not just the Federal Reserve in the United States, but central banks globally that at every turn have seemed to be there to support markets using these emergency measures, even though the economy seemed to be growing. So we fostered this idea that, well, the market had become a no-lose investment. And the question is now is that central banks are now changing their tone, but yet investors still have this inherent belief that no matter what happens, the Fed's going to show up at the doorstep. What do you think?
So they've been sort of trained like Pavlov's dog. And, you know, remember that policymakers are as susceptible to confidence, changes in confidence, as the retail investor. So it's never surprising to me to see jawboning by members of the Fed to either cool the markets or raise markets at critical turns. And again, that has played out in spades since October, where Jerome Powell was tempering markets' enthusiasm in early October and is now sort of trying to help investors see that maybe we don't need so many hikes in 2019. They're reactionaries.
Right. Well, we're talking with Peter Atwater. He is, of course, the author of the book Moods and Markets, a behavioral scientist, and, of course, adjunct professor, College of William & Mary, University of Delaware. We're going to take a quick break. We're going to come back, Peter, and pick up with this conversation about the Fed, Jerome Powell, obviously the Fed talking next week. And I want to talk about this idea of maybe, stopping these rate hikes. Does that really, while in the short term may be taken favorably, does it really change the longer term dynamic of what's going on here with the markets? We'll come back with Peter Atwater right after the break. Don't go away.
Got a question for Lance later? Ask now at realinvestmentadvice.com.
Welcome back to the Lance Roberts Show podcast right here at realinvestmentadvice.com. Our special guest today, Peter Atwater. He is, of course, the president of Financial Insights. That's spelled INSYGHTS. The why of what we do. And, of course, at financial-insights.com. Be sure and go by the website. Great source of information. Also the author of the book Moods and Markets. Peter Atwater on the line with me right now. Now, Peter and I were just talking about for the break a bit about the Federal Reserve, Jerome Powell, investor confidence. And, of course, we've had record levels of investor confidence over the last several years, record exuberance by investors. Now, all of a sudden, Peter, we have Jerome Powell talking about, well, maybe it's time to stop raising interest rates. And I found this a little bit interesting because in October, he said that, we're nowhere close to the neutral rate. The economy's still very strong. Employment's great. So we need to keep hiking rates. And, kind of on our deck right now is three more rate hikes into next year. Another one in December, three more next year. Now, all of a sudden, just a month later, a 10% decline in the market. Harsh words from the president about Jerome Powell's job as chairman of the Federal Reserve. What do you think? Did he fall prey to the issue of the markets and pressure from the White House?
I think he certainly felt prey to the pressure of the markets, but that is always the case with policymakers. President Trump tweets great news at the very top and then is, sort of slamming the table that rates are too high at major lows.
Right.
So, they are by nature individuals who respond to changes in confidence. In fact, most policymakers, political figures, that they've made a career of that. That's how they get reelected time after time after time.
Right.
So I'm not at all surprised. I think the danger for the Fed is that they were squirting water on a fire that was already on the way to burning itself out. So as is always the case, the hikes that we saw in the last 9 to 12 months were coincidental with a environment of confidence that was already peaking. So they unknowingly have contributed to greater potential downside.
Well, and that's an interesting point that you bring up about contributing to the greater, you know, the greater risk of the downside here. You know, we have this, again, this 10-year bull market behind us. The central bank has been there at every turn. And as we said, just before the break, investors have been trained like Pavlov's dogs. And it's interesting if you read, you know, a Twitter feed or you know, read comments on, you know, articles that are written by, you know, kind of the everyday average American. They absolutely believe that, this doesn't matter. It's a little dip in the market. Buy the dip because the Fed's always going to be there. You know, one of the big concerns here, though, is that now you have the Fed reducing their balance sheet by $50 billion a month. And despite the fact that Jerome Powell says, well, maybe we'll ease off on rate hikes a bit, they haven't talked anything about reducing that runoff on their balance sheet, which is probably the bigger risk than actually stopping rate hikes, don't you think?
Yeah, so the liquidity hose that was beneficial to investors has become more of a straw moving things the other way. You know, ultimately, if the markets can continue to move lower, the Fed will respond to that. The deleveraging of the Fed balance sheet will stop. In fact, there'll be jawboning about, you know, further increases in the balance sheet, the potential to monetize U.S. government debt. You know, those remain as options that are on the table in an extreme situation.
Yeah, but and it was kind of interesting because I actually wrote an article on Friday and I showed a graph of the Fed interest rate. And I hadn't really thought about this much until I'd actually posted this chart. But it was a picture of the federal funds rate going back to 2008 and the size of their balance sheet going back to 2008. And they were overlaid with each other. And it really kind of brought to light the issue that the Fed may run into moving into the next kind of maybe emergency measure bailout, because the Fed funds rate was 4.2% in 2008. The balance sheet was $900 billion. Today, the Federal Reserve rate is 2.25%, and the balance sheet's roughly $4 trillion, give or take. So in order to have the same type of magnitude of bailout during the next financial crisis, you're talking about a $16 trillion balance sheet, and they only have 2.25 points of downside to lower rates. The point of that whole bit of information, Peter, is to lead you to this question, which is, even if the Fed wanted to do another round of quantitative easing, even if they had the ability to do it or the desire to do it, it may be the issue that they don't have the capability of bailing out the next financial crisis, which is the real risk that may be lying out in front of investors, right?
Actually, I don't think that's nearly as significant as the risk of a populist reaction to, you know, further Fed action. I think that important and importantly different from what we saw a decade ago is that the post-banking crisis recovery has contributed to an extreme concentration in wealth. And I think that is important in terms of its limitation as far as Fed policy. Mm-hmm. I think the Fed is going to find itself painted in a corner where to bail out the markets is synonymous with bailing out the rich. And I'm not sure that in an environment where you have, you know, a rise up of populism, that the Fed is going to be very comfortable being seen as taking sides between owners and employees of capital.
Well, it may be too late for that. You know, again, you know, we look at where wage growth has been over the course of the last decade. You know, it's all in the top 20% of the population. To your point, you know, exactly one of the things, if you go back and look at where wealth actually moved during the bailout, it was a huge wealth transfer from the bottom 80% to the top 20. So, you know, absolutely to your point that, you know, the question becomes, since a large chunk of the population didn't participate with the rise in the markets anyway, you know, the next downturn, not only did they not participate on the way up, but now they lose their jobs or worse on the next way down. And that does potentially, you know, there's going to be a question at some point about where Make America Great didn't actually work, right?
Yes. That, you know, for the employees, this has been a really limp recovery.
Let's go to a break. And when we come back, Let's talk a little bit about the political environment here, not from the standpoint of, you know, Trump or, you know, whoever, right? Not the actual political characters, but, you know, from the standpoint of policy, trade, tariffs, you know, tax cuts, and what the impact has been, and to not only back to your point about confidence, but also what happens if we do get into a next recession. And from that standpoint, what I mean here is that we're running a $1 trillion deficit in economic expansion. What are you going to do if you hit a recession? We're talking with Peter Atwater. He is the president of Financial Insights, the why of what we do, financial-insights.com. He's also the author of the book, Moods and Markets. Behavioral psychology is a bit of the topic today about how investors look at the markets, how they react, and what the world may be around us and how that affects us going forward. Be right back. More with Peter Atwater right after the break.
You can get daily real investment news you can use, delivered at the speed of the internet. Sign up for Lance's newsletter now at realinvestmentadvice.com.
And welcome back to the Lance Roberts Show podcast. We're visiting with Peter Atwater today, the president of financialinsights.com. So, Peter, we left off talking a bit about the Federal Reserve and Jerome Powell and a bit about this wealth transfer effect that's occurred between the bottom 80% of the population. They haven't been part and parcel of this recovery. The wealthy have prospered greatly from this. And that really brings up an interesting question here, because in the since the election in 2016, the markets have done very well. There's been this general premise that because Donald Trump was elected president, that everything in the world had all of a sudden changed. And we saw corporate confidence go up sharply. We saw investor and consumer confidence jump markedly. And, you know, a lot of these, you know, economic indicators that people have looked at recently, unemployment rates and unemployment claims, et cetera, were already well into the trend of going lower over the last several years. But yet we came along and passed corporate tax cuts. This was really to give a big boost to the markets and to corporate earnings. And we did see the reflection in corporate earnings by seeing a large, you know, percentage gain in corporate earnings because of the reduction in taxes. But yet the markets really didn't participate like people thought. I mean, we're looking at a market that's essentially flat for the year as we speak right now, down just a little bit, but we've had record earnings. How did the markets not connect the two together?
Oh, the markets did connect the two together, but the markets did exactly what investors do, and that is they front run good news. And so the tax cut was priced in by the time it had been approved and signed by the president. And that is not uncommon, where you see investors fully valuing great news ahead. So that extrapolation was being priced in coming into 2018. The challenge for the administration in 2018, though, has been trying to balance the needs and wants of the financial elite with the chronic underconfidence that elected Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. And those two groups have two very different sets of preferences and needs. And to frame this, when we lack confidence, it's all about me here now. And to me, it's not surprising then that we've seen the president take a strategy for policy in things like border walls and tariffs, and you're trying to renegotiate existing treaties. There's very much a xenophobic mindset that goes along with low confidence that the president is pursuing in all aspects of foreign policy. Mm-hmm. That is the antithesis, though, of what us everywhere forever high confident investors are looking for. And so there's been this tension in the last 12 months between what the president is hoping to deliver to the investment community and what he's hoping to deliver to the Trump base.
You know, and that's an interesting point that you bring up here. And talking about confidence, you know, this has been one of the most, I think, divided couple of years that I've seen. I mean, there is such a strong pressure from one, you know, the people that don't like Donald Trump, very much against it. Everything that you can read or feel or hear about it, you can feel this basic revolt against the administration. If you are for the president, then he can do no wrong, no matter what it is that is done. He can simply do no wrong. And when he engages into some policy, like, say, tariffs, which have a long history of not being economically sound issues, you know, people say, well, it's part of a bigger strategy, and they give him a lot of credit for this. Now, the reason I ask you the question is not your position on whether he's doing a good job or not, but doesn't that psychological division between and such one that's so clearly visible in the country, does that not also impact the strength of economic growth going forward?
It does. I think that people are misguided when they are concerned about economic inequality. The much greater concern that I have is the confidence inequality that it exists in America. There's an enormous confidence gap between owners of capital and employees of capital.
Right.
And so the president early on in his administration tried to placate both sides. And, you know, what you've seen in the last year is an inability to keep going back from one side to the other. He's being forced to choose, you know, which of these groups do you really support, because their preferences, their objectives are contradictory.
Right.
And those, that back and forthness creates uncertainty for both groups. So you have farmers in Iowa who are now worried about tariffs, where in the past they had been supportive of tariffs.
But doesn't that also come back to the fact, Peter, that we also see, you know, that anxiety that's kind of going through the markets and the economy and as a whole, and showing that and seeing that show up in, you know, this raging kind of opioid epidemic that we have going on, you know, throughout the country now?
Yeah, one of the most fascinating charts to me is Google Trend data for the word anxiety or the phrase anxiety medication. From 2009 to earlier this month, it has been rising in a steady nature that is absolutely contradictory to what you would expect in an economic recovery. Typically, as markets get better, as job growth improves, the economy really takes off, you would see less anxiety. Mm-hmm. And that has not been the case at all. There is tension underneath the surface that is not getting pulled into and recorded by the economic statistics, like consumer confidence.
Yeah, and that's an interesting point that you bring up, Peter, because I know you look a lot at economic statistics and what's going on. And when I dig into things like, you know, the unemployment rate or jobless claims or interestingly enough, you know, the job opening and labor turnover survey, you know, when you start digging through this, then you read statistics says, okay, well, everybody that's got a job that wants a job, right? You've got 3.7% unemployment or whatever the number is. So obviously everybody's working that wants to work, but then you look at the other statistics, you know, 94 million people sitting outside the labor force, one out of every four households on some form of government subsidy. There's a big disconnect, or at least seems to me to be a big disconnect, between what the official economic data is versus what's happening in the real economy. Do you see the same thing?
Yeah, I think that the data is completely missing the really extreme anxiety that exists below the surface. The opioid epidemic is an example of that. And in fact, I would suggest that YouTube, Netflix, Pornhub, you know, all of this online video streaming that is just distracting and sort of placating has sort of filled a void, but we're exhausting it. You know, we can't binge watch anymore on Netflix. And so I think we're reaching a point where anxiety is now turning into action. I think we are behind countries like France, where we're really seeing the consequences of chronic underconfidence and anxiety now manifest in social unrest. But, you know, that, I think of that as a harbinger of things to come if we don't start to address the anxiety on Main Street that people are ignoring today.
We're talking with Peter Atwater. He is the president of Financial Insights. And Peter, while I step out and check my social media and Pornhub account, we'll be right back. And I want to talk about this social unrest and really the social unrest as it relates to social media, because as you said, you know, in France, Germany, every other country in the world, we're seeing this rise of unrest, this rise of a populist desire to see change by the people. But yet it seems like the elites don't really clue in to the message that's being sent. I want to come back and get your thoughts on that and wrap up our interview with Peter Atwater. Be right back after the break. Don't go away.
Got a question for Lance later? Ask now at realinvestmentadvice.com.
Welcome back to the Lance Roberts Show podcast right here at realinvestmentadvice.com. We've spent some time here with Peter Atwater today, president of Financial Insights Behavioral. Would you say that when we talk about behavioral issues, would you say behavioral science or behavioral psychology? Well, how would you classify that?
You can use either. I steer away from behavioral economics because I think that is too narrow a look. You know, the social sciences are too siloed, in my opinion, and cognitively we don't differentiate economic decisions from social decisions from cultural decisions.
Right. Well, just for the break, Peter, we were talking a bit about this opioid epidemic that we have in this country, and of course, recent studies out showing that social media, like Facebook and others, is actually contributing to the depression of Americans for a whole variety of reasons. And the amount of time that Americans spend on social media has been continuing to grow. And as you noted earlier, you know, binge watching, you know, Netflix and other things, video gaming, etc. It's interesting, you know, the phenomenon of Fortnite, 120 million Americans leading, you know, playing this video game, yet is leading to a rise in divorces between couples. So, you know, have we allowed too much technology and social media into our lives? Is this something that potentially Americans wake up and say, you know what, enough's enough. I need to get back to life.
Yes, I think that the nature of all of this me here now technology, whether it's Keurig cups to Twitter and selfies and all of this, there comes a point where it no longer offers the escapism that we're seeking.
Right.
You know, ultimately, we are people who need connection. And so what I think we're starting to see are grassroots connections as people form teams, groups, informal associations based on common need. And those tend to be formative during really lows in confidence. Some of them are extreme, but some of them are also quite philanthropic and charitable and compassionate. But we do come together and say, I can't take this anxiety anymore. I can't take this fear anymore. I have to do something about it.
Right. As when we take a look at companies, you know, Facebook has been kind of a prime culprit of trying to manipulate people's views on a variety of things. And of course, you know, we're inundated now with, you know, where we shop, how we shop. If you go online and look at some topic, it shows up on your social media feed at some point. You know, the indoctrination of our youth into the social media, it becomes questionable about the long-term effects about productivity. When we get back, let's get back to the economics of this, talking about long-term effects on productivity and innovation in the country. It seems to be that this is not advantageous to the long-term prosperity of the economic environment.
No, it isn't. And part of the reason that I think you will see it banned, outlawed, ignored, tossed aside, you know, I think about companies like Polaroid in the 1960s. It may seem like a silly equivalent, but, you know, the Polaroid camera was all about me here now.
Right.
But ultimately, it evaporated. You know, so as people will move on. And the question to me is, do we move on voluntarily or do we move on in response to a crisis? And there, I think that the behavior of teens at Parkland High School in response to gun shooting, the women marching, the Me Too movement. I mean, I think we're seeing subsets of America say, I've had enough of this, and now I'm going to mobilize and do something about it.
Well, I guess, and I think the interesting question or the interesting issue relative to what you just said is that it doesn't really matter whether it's the social media, the Me Too moment, et cetera, or it's the issue of our national debts and deficits, the problems that reign currently with Social Security or with pension funds that's potentially coming down the path. We never act in advance of the issue itself. It's always been a crisis that ultimately forces change. And in your opinion, is this time possibly different, or is it going to be another crisis that finally affects this change?
No, I think crisis will lead to change. Remember that underlying confidence requires perceptions of certainty and control. And a crisis defines the absence of both. These are traumatic events. And it's in those moments where fight or flight kick in, and we have to choose. Do we run or do we fight? And do we oppose? Do we take arms in terms of going after something that is the cause of our biggest fear? So behaviorally, everything rhymes. You know, it's never different. It's just a question of what the means to the behavior are.
Right. Well, and so I want to kind of wrap this up with, you know, kind of throwing this, you know, back to you for just a moment. I've been asking you a lot of questions here, but is there anything I didn't ask you that you feel is important that you'd like our listeners to pay attention to?
So I think that, you know, if I can recommend indicators of mood that are really important and significant for the future, watch what your teens are reading. Watch what they're watching. They are far ahead of the adults in coming to terms with this environment of extreme uncertainty. You know, they are going to mobilize far faster than, you know, we who are over the age of 50, because they have far less to lose. They're cognitively not as sophisticated as we are just developmentally. Mm-hmm. And so if I have one word of advice, it's watch what happens on college campuses and high school, because they are going to be the ones that drive what's next.
Well, if I take that piece of advice literally, and I have four kids between the ages of 12 and 18, if I take that piece of advice literally, Facebook is going bankrupt. because that's for old people. You know, Snapchat is going that way ultimately, and it's going to be interesting to see, you know, what the next innovations in gaming and a lot of their, you know, our television habits are, because they have, you know, my kids don't do much of anything for very long. They have very short attention span.
Yeah. And you know, some of that being a function of all of this technology.
Right.
But they are, based on what I see in terms of underlying sentiment in the classroom, they perceive the future as more certain than the present.
Interesting.
And that is not typically the case for people. Normally, the future means uncertainty, but for today's teens and young 20s, it's the future that is more certain. And so they're going to act to make that happen.
We've been talking with Peter Atwater today, right here at the Lance Roberts Show podcast. And Peter, of course, we appreciate your time very much. A great interview, and really appreciate you spending time with us. And I'd love to catch up with you in the future as things continue to develop. You know, a lot of things we've talked about today, I have a feeling we're going to be seeing here sooner than later. So I definitely want to get back with you and say, hey, remember when you said this?
So, I really appreciate the opportunity, Lance. Thank you so much.
Absolutely, Peter. And we'll get you a copy of this as well. And be sure and tune into our Lance Roberts Show podcast on YouTube and at our website at realinvestmentadvice.com for all of our interviews, great interviews with people like Peter and others. They're all on our website now under our podcast tab, realinvestmentadvice.com. And we'll see you next time on Lance Roberts Show.
Want a longer talk with Lance about your money? Request a personal one-on-one at realinvestmentadvice.com.